15th of the Inclination series. And just a quick note that in December, Federica Buetti will be coming to do a talk. So, but tonight it's Paul. And I'm very excited about your sort of double hybrid talk on technologies and machine oiserie, which, holds a lot of promise. So just to quickly introduce Paul, he's the academic coordinator of the Digital Cultures Research Lab at the Leuphana University in Lüneburg. He studied cultural studies and computer science at Humboldt University in Berlin. And from 2004 to 2011, he worked for Friedrich Kittler, and is now one of the main editors of his collected works, focusing on source code. So from 2010 to 2013, he's been a researcher at Humboldt's Institute for Media Theories, and is now undertaking his PhD entitled The Great Leap Forward, Incompleteness and Media Between China and the West. So you've probably seen his writing, because it appears in many publications, such as 032C, Freeze, Texas of Kunst, November, or November, I guess, Pinup, and Modern Weekly China. So he's published also texts with Wilhelm Finck, Merve Schoenberg Press, and Spectre Books. And he's also an editor for, I think, the recently launched Spheres.
Tomorrow, actually.
Tomorrow, oh, okay. that's not in Berlin, that's in Lüneburg.
That's in Lüneburg, okay. But it's an online journal, so you can all see.
Okay, so we'll all look forward to that. So tomorrow the launch of Spheres, which is focusing on post-media discourses, politics after the net, as well as digital activism. So without further ado, I will give you the floor. And thanks again for accepting the invitation.
thanks for the invitation. Good evening, everyone. So I'd have a couple of pages of text, which I basically just wrote down today. I'm not really sure how long the talk is going to take, but there will be enough time, definitely, for questions and discussion, which I hope will be plentiful. So, the problem begins in the very moment all problems seem to have disappeared. It's the year 1591, and a French lawyer named François Viette has just finished deciphering yet another declassified dispatch detailing the troop movements of Philip II of Spain's League. His method of cryptanalysis, using frequency analysis based on stochastic regularities found in all Roman languages, derived from the tacit knowledge of book printers since Gutenberg, is so good that he cannot but write down in a sentence the end and beginning of modern science. Nullum non problema solvere. There is no problem that cannot be solved. Philip of Spain is outraged and issues an official complaint with the Pope, like magic. The Pope doesn't say much, given the Vatican is an intelligence service itself and has always had its own in-house crypto team already cracking away at the codes of both parties. While using this cold numeric machete of a method to bushwhack through the sprawling jungle of letters, language, and meaning, Viette starts to develop another mathematical tool which would come to instill fear and loathing in humanity until today, algebra. And then the devil said, let's put the alphabet in math. With Viette's first rules for what we can call an operative symbolism, the actual insignia of modern science are born. The magic formula disappears and gives way to the mathematical formula. In Artem Analytica Misagoge, The Introduction to the Analytic Art, dedicated to the 11-year-old Catherine de Parthenay, whose teacher Viette was back then. It is important to make clear to yourself that mathematics didn't always look and work the way we learned it in school. Before Viette, mathematics was largely an art or craft used by engineers and merchants, a collection of solutions for special problems, mostly rhetorical or diagrammatical, but not formalized and generalized in the form of laws. Granted, there were the elements of Euclid, defining the architecture and hierarchy of mathematical knowledge and truths from definition to proof, but mathematics itself had no language of its own. In this very moment, shortly before the beginning of the 17th century, which would see an unprecedented explosion of scientific knowledge, it seems the alphabet had fulfilled its destiny in being able to become operative, crystalline, and formal, and describe everything like a precise, complete machine. No more problems. Viette's immense epistemologic leap was the concept of the variable, which is a direct result of his cryptoanalytic work. It is what you want to know, the unknown. the introduction of the variable into mathematics as a symbol that could mean or be anything, empty, thus pure, a signifier of signifiers, marks the emergence of a new way of epistemic practice. This is also the time of the Huguenot Wars, shortly to be followed by the 30 Years' War. This is the aftermath of Reformation and Counter-Reformation, a war of language and media technologies as well. Lutheran Bibles had not only open-sourced Christianity by translating the Latin into the respective national languages, but using Gutenberg's printing presses and a just-emerging postal network, media itself became one of the most significant agents of this movement. The Jesuit Counter-Reformation utilized the algorithmic meditation practice of Loyola's spiritual exercises to offer epiphanies to the general public, as well as state-of-the-art media in the form of the Jesuit theater. Cutting-edge stage tech, smoke and mirrors, phantasmagoria, laterna magica, and so on, to create a synesthetic experience of the sufferings of the agonies of hell. Europe burst into a million pieces and languages. Latin slowly but surely ceased to be the lingua franca. But still remember, nullum non problema solvere, there is no problem, because we have the means of finitude and permutation. We have a discrete set of symbols and rules to compute old and create new. It is, however, darkly humorous and significant in an almost Lacanian way that it is also precisely at this time when language seems to come to a close and science opens its eyes to a powerfulness which would eventually become the paradigm of the modern world, that something emerges from the East to utterly subvert and twist the well-engineered and oiled springs, coils, and gears of the operative symbolism of Baroque science. Almost in the same year Viet publishes his introduction, the first letters of one of two Jesuit missionaries who, after long and perilous voyages, made it to the realms of Cathay or Sina, start arriving in Europe. They tell of an industrious civilization with highly developed sciences, and of a writing system which resembles the alphabet in no way. Instead of being discrete and representing phonetic values as vowels and consonants, the curious Chinese signs seem to directly represent things in a possibly pictographic way. And therefore, for each thing, there had to be a new sign, making it a sprawling, potentially infinite writing system with few grammatical rules, but, or so Europe thought, surely some kind of underlying magic mechanism governing the way that these imagic symbols describe the real. No linear order, not from A to Z, but a rhizomatic structure, growing, shrinking, transforming, just like language and thought itself. Chongwen, the Chinese writing system, subsequently floods the minds of European thinkers of the 17th century in a wave of speculative philosophy. Surely it must be the Adamic language, or invented by Hermes Trismegistos, or maybe an infernal language after all, as a Protestant theologian writes. Those characters could only have been introduced by, quote, devil and God's doom to keep the wretched ensnared in the darkness of idolatrousness. No, it's an ancient Egyptian high priest system, writes polymath Athanasius Kircher. Francis Bacon, not the painter but the creator of Nova Atlantis, on the other hand, is convinced that we are dealing with so-called characters real, representing ideas directly, thus creating the idea of an ideographic system, an alphabet of thought. John Wilkins, founding secretary of the Royal Academy, has high hopes when he writes that, quote, "Nay, the confusion at Babel might this way have been remedied if everyone could have expressed his own meaning by the same kind of character." John Webb, author of the book with the beautiful title, "The Antiquity of China or an Historical Essay Endeavoring the a Probability that the Language of the Empire of China is the Primitive Language Spoken Through the Whole World Before the Confusion of Babel," eventually gives us the most important clue as to the importance and moral superiority of this wondrous writing. Quote, "And what is more, they have not any character by which to write the privy parts." With the mathematical formula, born from the crypto codes of war, which always already has been information warfare, even though that term was only coined in 1984 by a signal officer of the Chinese People's Liberation Army called Chen Weiguang, the concept of code, of N and decoding, and thus of a concept of information storage, processing, and transmission, becomes the defining epistemologic container of modern science. There has to be a code. There has to be a possibility of reduction, of essence, which bears a big portion of alchemical ideas still prevalent, of a key. It is thus clear that Western thinkers and tinkerers immediately immersed themselves in finding a so-called clavis sinica, a key to the mysteries of the mechanics of this writing system from the other side of the world. Or the moon, as some sources say in Baroque sci-fi. Yes, that's a thing. The first key was created here in Berlin. In 1667, Andreas Müller, Orientalist and Provost of the Nikolai Church on Alexanderplatz, claims he has succeeded. With his key, he boasts even women could be able to understand and learn Chinese. This creates a lot of buzz, but he keeps postponing publication. What he does publish is a small pamphlet citing all the reasons not to publish, unless someone would be willing to pay the handsome fee of 2,000 thaler. Friedrich Wilhelm even paid 1,000, but to no avail. In 1679, Müller receives a letter from Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Leibniz, besides having founded symbolic logic in his dissertation on the combinatoric art when he was just 20, inventing calculus shortly thereafter to, for the first time, make continuous phenomena of nature seamlessly describable, thus ushering in the age of simulation, and being the universal scientist we all know him as, was also one of the experts on all things Chinese of his time, being in contact with all the great Orientalists in Europe, as well as the Jesuit missionaries in China. As many others in the 17th century too, Leibniz was working on ideas of a universal writing system, a lingua characteristica universalis, a calculus ratiocinator, by which people of different tongues could nevertheless communicate, and what is more, concepts could be tested for their validity and truths and answers calculated. This being nothing but the rise of the idea of computability against the background of Lullian combinatorics, mathematical formulas, etc. Leibniz asked Müller 15 questions on the constructive principles of the Chinese language and writing system and suggested he translate a Chinese book for him. Müller, of course, took the job and the money, but never delivered. A few years later, Müller was convicted of heresy and thrown in prison in Spandau. According to his own record, he burned all of his dubious materials on the Chinese key upon his release. Leibniz, however, is the person we want to have a closer look at here, for various reasons. First, Leibniz can be read as the first media thinker. While his mathematical work builds the foundations for today's computing machinery, i.e. some symbolic logic translated into logic gates, differential equations running every simulation algorithm ever since, and his engineering work, especially on a four-species calculating machine, contributed greatly to the idea of mechanization processes of calculation and ultimately thought, he was also perhaps the first thinker of the postal system or of the network. For Leibniz, a graphomaniac who left us with, as they say, barns full of paper, thinking meant sketching and distributing. Instead of just sitting in his chamber and writing heavy books, Leibniz sent out thousands of letters to his personal network spanning the whole planet with over 1,200 nodes, reaching as far as Beijing. But at the same time, the academy network and the academy system begins to free academic knowledge from church and court. Being in a network becomes a defining dispositive of knowledge production. Secondly, Leibniz's way of working on incorporating Chinese knowledge into his system makes him the first truly international thinker, with high hopes but without exotism. Leibniz, who jokingly referred to his office as the Bureau d'Adresse pour la Chine, can without exaggeration be said to be substantially influenced by Chinese knowledge on almost all of his levels of endeavor. He even published a journal sensationalistically called Novissima Sinica, the latest news from China. The Chinese whispers in our seemingly purely Western lineage of knowledge are much louder and clearer than we are usually aware of, because it is a Western Christian colonial politics of the history of knowledge and its branding. Even when Leibniz invents the binary notation for numbers, China plays a big role. Leibniz didn't know what to do with it. Representing numbers with 1 and 0 was a mental exercise for him which didn't yet have any application. Initially, it was not 0 and 1, but simply the two most distinct figures in a Euclidean and pre-Socratic way, circle and line, that he used. So Leibniz does what he does and sends out a couple of letters. A while later, he receives a response from Joachim Bouvet, a Jesuit priest in Beijing. Bouvet says, look, your binary construction, it looks just like the construction of the tree and hexagrams of the I Ching, the Book of Changes. And those trigrams, it is said that they are the original eight characters of the Chinese writing system, as invented by the legendary Emperor Fuzi 7,000 years ago. So Leibniz thinks, well, it seems I have rediscovered an ancient truth that connects us with the Chinese writing system, mathematics, logic, the operations of the mind. And so, 2 decades later, he ultimately publishes his Explication de l'arithmétique binaire, even sketching out first ideas for a binary calculating device. What's interesting for us here tonight, however, is also the way that nature and technology and art and science relate to each other during that time. Descartes' mechanical world and the clean formalisms of mathematics, which have finally been rid of any Kabbalistic or alchemical residue, are the preconditions for Baroque science as a consistent system. Leibniz himself writes, quote, "Thus we may applaud the modern Chinese interpreters when they reduce the government of heaven to natural causes, and when they differ from the ignorant populace, which is always on the lookout for supernatural, or rather supracorporeal miracles, and spirits like Deus ex machina. And we shall be able to enlighten them further on these matters by informing them of the new discoveries of Europe, which have furnished almost mathematical reasons for many of the great marvels of nature, and have made known the true systems of the macrocosm and the microcosm." In Leibniz's world, however, Descartes' mechanistic world is a thing of the past already. Leibniz, in his living network, is the first thinker of ecologies and organicism. We witness the world changing from a necessary theodicy, justifying the existence of evil in the world and the existence of God, to that of what we might call a technodicy, the description of an all-encompassing machine made up of organic parts. The language it is written in is Chinese, the language of which no one knows how it works. Its characters are monads, the language, its environment, its grammar and ecology without nature. Practicing this science means creating art. In the decades before his Requiem, the Monadology, which was only published after his death, Leibniz immerses himself deeply in Neo-Confucian philosophy. While also starting a discourse on the philosophy and workings of simple substances with Arnaud in Port Royal, he is in a dense exchange with Nicolas Raymond, who urges him to expand on things Chinese. So in early January 1716, shortly before his death, Leibniz completes the first manuscript of his Discours sur la théologie naturelle des Chinois, and in his text analyzes the ancient natural philosophical concepts of the Li and the Qi, which translate roughly to pattern and pneuma. Qi like in Qigong. Interestingly enough, the definitions Leibniz gives for Li and the way one Li is organized with an infinity of other Li corresponds one-to-one with the definitions he gave later on for his monads. He simply replaced Li with monad. So at the core of the Occidental philosophy of substance and perception lies a 1,000-year-old Chinese Easter egg. Joseph Needham, author and editor of the seminal series Science and Civilization in China, as well as biochemist, described the monadology as a system of thought, quote, "which was strongly influenced by, if not indeed derived from, the organic world outlook, which we have found to be characteristically Chinese. It might almost be said that the monads were the first appearance of organisms upon the stage of Occidental philosophy. The hierarchy of monads and their pre-established harmony resembled the innumerable individual manifestations of the Neo-Confucian Li in every pattern and organism. Each monad mirrored the universe like the nodes in Indra's net." Christoph Harbsmeier, author of one of the last volumes in Needham's series on language and logic, folds this organicism back onto language. Quote, "Chinese grammatical structures are only sufficiently well-defined to articulate meaning, but at the same time flexible enough not to impose rigid structure where such structure does not serve an articulatory or communicative purpose. The Chinese would then not only have held an organicist worldview, they would also have expressed this worldview in a medium of communication which was much more organically supple and less rigid in its articulatory strategies than languages like Latin or Greek. Grammatical suppleness and flexibility should not be confused with mechanical grammatical looseness or lack of precision. Classical Chinese grammar is certainly much more precise than would appear from current descriptions. Organisms are precisely structured subtle things. They are more highly structured than a very advanced rigid device. What I am suggesting is that Chinese is highly structured in subtle and supple ways, analogous to those of organisms. When Descartes' mechanical universe paved the way for modern science, it ultimately had to become organic. This might correspond with the way we think today about digital cultures becoming ecological in a neo-cybernetic way. Descartes rearranged space by uncoupling it from representation and creating symbolic tools for the mind, which he thought much more powerful than images, in the form of analytic geometry, figures as letters in algebraic formalisms. Leibniz's system is alive. His nature, the nature he is able to describe in all its continuity and flux through infinitesimal calculus, that he can actually simulate given enough computing power, which he never had, is one that ideally brings forth its own writing systems, almost like Talbot's pencil of nature. In the nativity scene of modern technology, the very beginning of the idea of technologization of the world, of computability and finitude, there is an uncontrolled growth, which, could it be cultivated and understood, would provide true access to the mind and eliminate the threshold between nature and culture, art and science, technologies and ecologies. Leibniz, as you can see, is far ahead of his time. Yet around 1700, Leibniz ultimately still has to write a theodicy, a justification of the existence of God. It's simply a life insurance. The Jesuit mission in China ultimately comes to a grinding halt when the Vatican decides to try and ban ancestor worship in China, upon which the Chinese simply said fuck off and kicked out all the Western missionaries. The predominantly scientific exchange with China, happening before, about which I haven't even begun to tell you about and won't for the sake of brevity, ends around the same time Leibniz dies. The next missionaries to enter China over the coming centuries bring opium rather than mathematics, and Bibles rather than astronomy. Europe, at the same time, sinks back into the misty-eyed enlightenment, chinoiserie of Sanssouci in Potsdam, pretty patterns in ladies' fashion rather than the lee of nature, and the uncanny valley of post-Baroque automata rather than calculating machines. The ecology of knowledge that Leibniz envisioned, spanning and connecting the globe as an organic network, is fragmented into single scientific disciplines which become ever more powerful in probing the nature of reality and slowly become monstrous and self-referential if we look at, for example, Dirichlet's or Weierstrass's non-derivable functions, which, to follow Bernard Siegert in his argument, already show signs of oscillation as electricity slowly starts with its first sparks. Space becomes multidimensional and non-Euclidean, warped and twisted, and mathematics gives access to realms inaccessible to imagination by producing them. In the 18th and 19th century, the idea of the environment, of the milieu, becomes more and more prevalent, while metaphysics, starting with Leibniz, gets gradually replaced by metamathematics, which at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries becomes the ultimate paradigm of human knowledge and precondition of computing technology. The philosophical environment, the formalistic ecology, becomes what David Hilbert, king of the mathematicians, around 1900, will come to call the, quote, paradise which Georg Cantor has created for us and from which nothing will drive us. Finally, infinities. But countable infinities, one bigger than the other, measurable against each other and aptly called Aleph. Georg Cantor's infinite sets or manifolds, as he originally called them, resonate with Leibniz's membranous monads, and mark the reemergence of both the Baroque organicism sans animism we have encountered before and the idea of complete describability of reality, its dimensions and organization. The Hilbert program of meta-mathematics, which set out to prove the consistency of mathematics and waterproof the system in order to ultimately transform it into the computer, goes hand in hand with the fin de siècle fetishism for the paranormal. The media technologies of the 19th century were, after all, nothing but spiritual media. Telephones to speak to the dead, daguerreotypes to make visible hidden spirits, phonograph noise with faint voices in the background, radio seances, etc. Even later, in the early 20th century of the logical positivists in the Vienna Circle, consulting an affirmative unary medium like the Ouija board, which translates to the yes-yes board, was just as present as may even be seen as another precondition for the first ideas for digital binary media in the form of our yes-no machines of today. Geologies and entomologies, insect metaphors, entered the discourse of technology around the same time too, as Jussi Parikka has shown. Swarms and clouds have been around much longer than we think. The true agent of contingency, the eco-terrorist in Hilbert's anorganic crystal palace of formalism with their symbolic death wish, is a young neo-Leibnizian paranoiac named Kurt Gödel. Just like Hilbert follows Leibniz in his contemporaries' ideas of finitude, of completeness and computability, so does Gödel. But Gödel, at around age 20, reads a text by Leibniz on the universal language and concept of truth computation, which starts out in China and the idea of reducibility of the Chinese characters to certain radical signs or prime factors, as Leibniz concludes. Prime factoring is a very important concept for cryptology, basically the core concept of cryptology. If we can find the prime factors of certain concepts, their unambiguous elements, we might easily prove logic by arithmetical means, he concludes. Which is exactly what Gödel does with Hilbert's system, showing that there is no ultimate complete system that is also consistent. Gödel's so-called incompleteness theorem is very interesting and also quite funny, but too complex to explain here tonight. Essentially, he creates little logical creatures that open their eyes and at the same time negate their own presence, thus turning the formally consistent logical system into an eco-conscious organism with paradox traits, showing the thresholds of what is thinkable at all. All this happens in 1913. Alan Turing will shortly after essentially do the same in his seminal paper on computable numbers with an application to the Entscheidungsproblem, and thus formulate the limits of computability, setting things in motion for the digitalization of the world. Around the same time, Norbert Wiener, whom you might know as the father of cybernetics, moves to Beijing to teach engineering and mathematics at Tsinghua University and study the Chinese language and philosophy. Before him, John Dewey, Bertrand Russell, Alfred North Whitehead, whose Process and Reality is a seminal book for thinkers of the ecological and environmental and was described by Whitehead himself as essentially Chinese, and Albert Einstein traveled to China and gave lectures. Bertrand Russell's interpreter during his journeys, a young mathematician and linguist named Chao Yun-ren, would later also befriend Wiener and contribute greatly to the foundation of cybernetics during the Macy conferences of the early 1950s. He is also responsible for the first Chinese translation of Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which became such a big hit in China that it spawned China-exclusive sequels such as Alice's Adventures in China. Because what comes after Wonderland and is even weirder if not China. He also wrote pop songs and coined the English word for stir fry for Asian cuisine. Very interesting guy. Norbert Wiener and his Chinese colleague Yuk-Wing Li built electrical networks and analog computers while in China. But at the same time, with Wiener being exposed to the Chinese language and philosophies of Neo-Confucianism and Taoism, essentially philosophies of the organic and of the process, it is safe to say that the very early ideas for cybernetics, with this very special approach to techno environments and organomachinic feedback processes came into being in China. I went through large parts of the Norbert Wiener archive at the MIT a while ago, dreaming, as you can imagine, of hand-sketched circuits and networks mingling with Chinese writing practice, gradually merging and entangling, but so far to no avail. I keep looking and hopefully we'll be able to show you the next time. In the meantime, we can discuss the ideas I've quickly sketched out here, the tricky transmissions between different systems, ecosystems, if you will, of thought, language, and writing, of technologies as organisms, and vice versa. Thanks for listening.
No, I think it's really good. If someone has an immediate question, feel free. For myself, it's a lot of new material and a very broad spectrum to kind of take in all at once. Does anyone have a question they're like burning to ask immediately? Okay.
I think what I was trying to demonstrate mainly is, I mean, don't bother too much with the details because I know it's quite a lot and I've been working on this for a while now, but mainly what I was trying to show and what we could discuss is the way that all those discourses that are quite prevalent right now, the Anthropocene, eco-thinking, ecologies without nature, and stuff that Timothy Morton and people like that do, actually have a much longer history than you would imagine, and also history which is sometimes, even if it's looked at actually, for my taste, too Eurocentric and too logocentric, especially if you look at something like, if you try to uncover a little bit what the Chinese influence on Western thought was, I think that's something that should be taken into account a little bit more.
Can you talk more about why Chinese was perceived to be closer to the real? And maybe this is connected to the organicism that you're showing as being associated with the Chinese monads. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious how this justification of how it's more closer to reality, this language, what are the texts themselves from that period saying?
Well, I mean, of course, this is all completely based on a very rough misunderstanding of the Chinese language. That's the whole point, you know? So you have to imagine that in the 17th century, when knowledge of the Chinese writing system and language first sort of starts to trickle into Europe, because it's really trickling, it's not like, I mean, you know, letters still take a couple of years to arrive, is that people, of course, speculate a lot what the Chinese writing system is actually made of. But the thing is, and what I've been trying to sort of hint at, is that while the movement of language and the formalization of language in Europe at the same time is one of discretization, of sort of making the system smaller and more waterproof and more operative, more feasible for formalization, is that at the same time this other writing system, which is just really sprawling, where basically you just like us have a word for everything, but you also have a certain very distinct character for it. You know, we have 26 letters, but they have, at that time in this first epic, it's like, wow, they have like 75,000 characters, which is a rough estimate for like the 1590s, you know? So the idea is that there must be something really precise in it, because we, like the Chinese, they invent a character for each thing. So there has to be some kind of an idea behind it that already transports with it the concept, the image, like the mental image, of this thing that it's trying to describe, which can be like an object, but also like an idea. And this is something that it remains very dominant until the 19th century, where people like S.R. Pound, for example, take up the concept again and create what one very interesting researcher whose name escapes me is called ideographic modernism, which he links back and says like all the ideas of this sort of self-evident knowledge creation that media technologies bring forth, like the way that that the latent image starts to disappear, or that nature writes itself in photography, in early photography, is something that is actually derived from this idea that the Chinese characters are already images that are written by nature themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, they sort of come into being. They're not a formalism, but they're rather an organism. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this holds true for both the way that the characters themselves are created, but also how the grammar works, as this quote by Christoph Habsmeyer tried to say, that it's something that is very loose, but at the same time, it's not unprecise. It has a different way of working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a question about, because I see it kind of as a, you're kind of contrasting Euclid and Hilbert, for example, mm-hmm. Which I always kind of, there was a really great lecture I attended from Giuseppe Longo about a month ago, who was talking about how this sort of geometric view or the split between Euclid and Hilbert or Frege also, mm-hmm. Also created a kind of foundation of abstraction. So like Euclidean geometry always had to be in the space, and this kind of meta-mathematical language, so like a self-referential, what we call unnatural, mm-hmm. or formal language. And how that plays into computation that has to do specifically with the life sciences. Because that was a specific limitation that he pointed out. He said this move of abstraction and this kind of meta-mathematization for sure built up the affordances of a lot of digital capacities. Mm-hmm. But when it came down to the life sciences, he was using a like, very concrete example of like cancer research, that is always context-based. So you couldn't use this fully abstract process to... so it wasn't like mappable universally, is basically what he was saying. So he was saying like this move of Hilbert Frege's like afforded a certain capacity, yet this sort of more, you could say, context-based ancient geometry of like Euclid, mm-hmm. Would be more applicable to life science. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how, I know it's a bit weird because I'm throwing a different reference, but if those two worlds...
No, it's highly interesting. Yeah, I mean, I never really thought about the connection between Euclid and the life sciences. It's very interesting. I might have to think about it for a while, though.
Sure.
You know, what I was trying to show is that there is this sort of leap from Baroque to Hilbert, basically, with where they have the same idea, you know? Like, mm-hmm. in Baroque, you have the idea that, well, finally, we have the mathematical or the, say, epistemologic means to formalize, to describe. And so naturally the idea is completeness, restlessness. Mm-hmm. Like we can, without any residue, without any remainder, describe the whole world, which, I mean, basically from the idea, it's true, it's what big data does today, you know? Mm-hmm. It's the same mathematical principles that that computers and large-scale simulations use today. And that sort of falls apart at the end of Baroque, and then as I tried to show, is that, you know, like during the Enlightenment and the early 19th century, universal science stops to happen and it becomes fragmented into different disciplines, which is quite necessary, I think, in order for these disciplines to sort of really become as powerful as they turn out to be, you know, because of course if you're always preoccupied with also trying to think about the philosophy of mathematics, mm-hmm. you miss out on quite some time to do actual mathematics and vice versa. So at the end of the 19th century with Hilbert, this idea starts to reemerge. And so meta-mathematics is the idea that you can actually step out of the mathematical system and have a look at it from outside and try to evaluate whether it is consistent or not, mm-hmm. which is necessary. So what Hilbert and those people do is essentially they already create a computer, just sit and sort of don't put one and one together and like have the idea. So they have the formal means, and on the other hand, you also start to have the technology, mm-hmm. for it, but they really haven't put it together yet. And this is where Leibniz, where Gödel and Turing come into play, which may be sort of some loose answer response to your question, because what they show is that there is sort of there is an incompleteness, there's sort of a chasm, it's like an impurity in the system that is very necessary for it to work, you know? As for the life sciences, well, thanks for the suggestion, I have to think about it really.
Well, it's
seems to me that the life sciences would be that impurity. So
maybe
that kind of a false move in a way to attempt to apply a pure language on it, like essentially impure, i.e. super contextually and contingent based phenomena of study.
But how do they, why are they closer to Euclid?
He was only making that link because of the because in the ancient geometry always had to have, it was like extremely concrete in the sense that it was like always related to a spatial articulation.
It was, but at the same time, I mean, as the 19th century and the emergence of non-Euclidean geometry showed, is that it was basically so abstract that that it was not natural at all.
It
could
be not for a particular.
Exactly, and
so it's
like
it was
the Euclidean geometry is the only geometry not occurring in nature.
Yes.
You know? So that's why it's, that I'm a bit puzzled, because it's already idealized. You know, it's
sure.
But it's very interesting.
And I would have another question, which is, let's say, more general. I wasn't exactly sure how, again, this is a kind of relational question, how just general notions of finitude and infinitude, because these were like terms that kept peppering and kept coming up in your talk, how those interrelate in sort of contemporary computation.
Well, I mean, we still have the thing that we, I mean, we can describe almost anything, which is what we do now with large-scale simulations. But of course, there remains something that's not computable by definition, by what Turing and Gödel showed us, that by definition, in the process of computing, there's something that's unreachable. I mean, some people try to construct also sort of a metaphysical argument for that, which I think is not entirely necessary, but the idea about finitude is that you can see in the Baroque, you know, with, as I said, the tools that you have, suddenly you have the feeling that it might be possible, you know. So it's only Gödel and Turing that show that it's possible to formalize almost everything, but not everything. And but before that, that's I mean, the person I didn't really speak very much about is Georg Cantor's. Very interesting in that context, because he does this crazy thing that in the late 19th century he just sets out and said, well, infinity is really a very interesting thing. How about we just count to infinity? Like, how about I just invent a mathematical procedure, which is called the diagonal procedure, with which I am able to count to infinity, and with which I can also show that there are different kinds of infinities. So there's one infinity that is also infinite, but it's bigger than the other infinity. So the idea is that you have two different sets of numbers. One is natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is infinite. You can always add one more, you know, it's quite clear. It's very, very evident to the mind. And then there's another set, which is the real numbers, which is 1.00001, etc., which is a continuum. So it's also infinite. You can also, you know, add as many points behind the comma as you wish, but it is quite clear that it's not mappable onto the other set of infinities. If you try that one, you know, just try to write them down, that it's also infinite, but it's a bigger infinity than the other one. You know, it's a more powerful infinity, as it's called. So, and this is something that sets the foundation for everything that Hilbert knows. So the idea that set theory organizes number theory, organizes this realm of mathematics and of thinking is, and I try to imagine what it must have felt like as a mathematician around 1900 to suddenly be able to grasp this concept, you know, and to be able to deal with it, you know, not have it as a religious or metaphysical concept that people have sort of tried to grasp for centuries and millennia. But to actually be able to write it down, you know, and to work with it. And then, of course, with set theory, you had all these problems, that Russell's paradox, for example, or the basically was at the core also of
Goethe's proof is the Laius paradox, which all of you know, I guess. Mm-hmm. So like the one guy from Crete says all people from Crete are liars. So this is what Goethe does. He takes the system and he shows that within the systems there are creatures that say, like, I'm not part of the system yet, I'm here. Mm-hmm. Fuck you.
Question. I was curious to know what you make of it in light of the general theory of relativity. If you take into account gravity, then Euclidean geometry kind of falls apart. I just watched Interstellar last night.
I know, yeah. No spoilers.
I recommend it.
Super easy question, thanks. it's a rough question, but I mean, what's interesting is that Goethe and Einstein were actually best friends in Princeton from the 1930s onwards, and Goethe himself constructed special solutions to the general theory of relativity, making time travel possible in 1948. So you should have a look at that, and that's about all I can say about the general theory of relativity. I'm sorry.
You mentioned milieu, and I can't remember what you were saying about how environment is starting to come into play, but I was curious also to be backing on Patricia's question about thinking about then where biosemiotics fits in this narrative. I don't know anything about whether Leibniz and this lineage that you're tracing could be tracked forward to thinking about the way that people like von Uxkull are theorizing Umwelt later to think about precisely in the life sciences semiotics and formalizing communication. Mm. So it's kind of out of left field, but I wonder if there's any lineage that can be tracked up that way.
I have a hunch, but I'm not sure about the lineage, because this is also something that I've been trying to sort of newly come up with for this talk and also for my dissertation. Maybe actually I can pass the question on to an expert on this question, my colleague Florian Sprenger, whom I work with at the DCI, and who's very familiar with all the sort of 18th and 19th century discourses of the milieu.
Well, I'm not sure there's any kind of lineage.
Yeah.
The term environment, at least phrased from 1860, so it's a really new term and it hasn't been used before. And the term milieu is used as a translation in French, is translation of the British or the Latin term medium, mm-hmm. for the first time, and then becomes a very different phrase in biology and sociology. But I'm not sure if there's any connection to madness. I don't think so.
I think so. No, I don't think so either. Not to Leibniz, but I think it's sort of, when I was writing this today, I sort of had the feeling that the way that Leibniz creates an idea of organic systems in a way is something that it could make sense if you look, because I always had this problem that there's like a big gap between Leibniz, Cantor, and Gödel, and something happens in between, and I think maybe this sort of looking at the way that Leibniz developed organic systems could relate to what in the 1800s comes about with the environment, but I'm not sure yet. It's sort of this is like a test balloon.
Any more questions? Are you good?
I'm.
Unless we feel the need to give a no.
I'm fine.
Okay. Well, then yeah, we can just like hang out here for a bit or grab a drink outside or something. But thank you very much for your
thank
time.
You.
It was really, really good.
Still running? Maybe just press stop, I don't know.